Welcome, welcome, welcome to this panel on whether executive soft power is a threat to free speech. My name is Mike Domino. It is my pleasure to be the chairman of the Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group. I'm also a professor at the Widener Commonwealth Law School in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I am going to give the pre-introduction here. As I mentioned, this panel is sponsored by the Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group. And any of you who are interested in joining or playing more of a role in various practice groups, and there are 15 of them, may contact Nate Kaczmarek of the Federalist Society, who is the director of the practice groups. The practice groups organize panels such as this one, but not exclusively this one. We organize several different panels and teleforums throughout the year, and it has been my great pleasure to work with with several very, very accomplished and nice and dedicated lawyers who serve with me on the executive committee. Today, it's also my pleasure to introduce the Honorable Britt Grant of the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, who will moderate this panel. Judge Grant is a native of Atlanta. She graduated from Wake Forest and Stanford, where she was the president of the student chapter of the Federalist Society. She has been Solicitor General of the state of Georgia and a member of the Georgia Supreme Court before being appointed by President Trump to the 11th Circuit. Please join me in welcoming Judge Grant.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me? Is that on? Okay, great. No? How about now? All right. thank you. I'm really happy to be here. This is a very timely topic. We'll get into a lot of reasons why very shortly. I will introduce the panelists, but first, before I do that, in case anyone has missed this description, I thought that I could not do it better myself. So I'm going to read the description from the Federal Society. There are no federal speech police, but law enforcement is not the only way that executive officials and agencies take aim at disfavored speech and speakers. In recent months, officials have pressed social media companies to ban those accused of spreading COVID misinformation, announced a task force to investigate parents speaking out at local school board meetings, and looked on as financial service providers dropped controversial clients their regulators might find presented reputational risk. Meanwhile, agencies increasingly wield broadly worded anti-discrimination laws to encourage institutions and businesses to police speech by students, faculty, and employees. Is officials' use of soft power over speech a new phenomenon, or is it merely more visible in the age of social media and pervasive regulatory oversight? And what role should the First Amendment play when officials stop short of punishing speech themselves? So I think you'll hear soon that these are four of the perfect people to give us some more insight on this topic. I'll introduce them in the order that they will speak, and then everyone will give about 8 minutes of remarks. Don't throw tomatoes if it goes to 8.5 minutes, but we'll try to keep it tight. And then after that, we'll have some time for discussion amongst the panelists and then time for questions at the end. We'll start with Mr. Mark Chenoweth. He's the president and general counsel of the New Civil Liberties Alliance. His career features public service in all three branches of the federal government, as well as private sector experience in law firm, in-house, and nonprofit settings. Mark is a graduate of Yale College and the University of Chicago Law School, and has contributed published work to outlets including the New York Times, San Francisco Chronicle, Los Angeles Daily Journal, and Forbes.com. Next, we have Mr. Michael Ellis. He's the general counsel at Rumble. That is a privately owned company working in the video sharing platform industry. Michael has previously served as general counsel of the National Security Agency and in several roles with the Trump administration, including deputy assistant to the president and senior director for intelligence programs at the National Security Council, otherwise known as the NSC. Prior to his service at the White House, Michael spent time as a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies and as general counsel of the U.S. Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Michael clerked for Judge Jeffrey Sutton of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit and for Judge Emul Thapar, then on the District Court in Kentucky. He's also a graduate of Yale Law School and Dartmouth College and has served as an intelligence officer in the U.S. Navy Reserve since 2007. Happy Veterans Day. Next, we have Mr. Joe Cohn, Legislative and Policy Director at the Foundation for Individual Rights Expression, also known as FIRE. His experience includes service as a staff attorney for the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit and a law clerk in the Philadelphia Court of Common Pleas. Additionally, his lifelong commitment to the advancement of civil liberties led him to work as a staff attorney at the AIDS Law Project of Pennsylvania and interim legal director for ACLU affiliates in Nevada and Utah. He has taught at the University of Pennsylvania Law School as an adjunct professor and as a graduate of UNLV and the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Last but certainly not least is Professor Enrique Armijo, a professor of law at the Elon University School of Law. He's also an affiliate fellow of the Yale Law School Information Society Project and the UNC Chapel Hill Center for Information Technology and Public Life, and a fellow at the George Washington University Institute for Data, Democracy, and Politics. His areas of interest include the First Amendment, constitutional law, torts, administrative law, media and internet law, and international freedom of expression. His work has also appeared in several law reviews, including the Cato Supreme Court Review. Additionally, his work has been cited by multiple federal agencies and presented in testimony before the U.S. Senate. As a practicing attorney, he advised clients on media and law issues, and his commentaries on many topics have appeared in NPR, Voice of America, Bloomberg Law, The Charlotte Observer, and several other outlets nationwide. Will you join me in welcoming our panelists? All right, Mr. Chenoweth, you are up first.
Thank you, Judge Grant, and thank you to the Federalist Society and the Free Speech Practice Group for inviting me to be a part of today's forum. The administrative state takes away your free speech to increase its power every day. Speech bans, mandates, and restrictions are tools that administrative agencies use to violate your civil liberties. Like a 10-year-old losing an argument, the government wants you to shut up when it disagrees with what you have to say, and it will use this shut-up shortcut unless and until federal courts put a stop to it. NCLA has taken aim at speech bans, mandates, and licenses, and we will continue to fight these pernicious practices, even if the ACLU won't. Before turning to a few examples in greater detail, let me set the stage for this afternoon's discussion by mentioning briefly some instances of speech suppression that fall into each of these various categories. First come speech bans. These are prior restraints on speech, which the Supreme Court has said are the least defensible and worst kind of speech restriction. Examples include speech bans that attach to settlement agreements at the SEC and CFTC, and laws that forbid asking about a potential hire's salary history, as well as FERC's terrible proposed new duty of candor rule. Second come speech mandates. Compelled speech is very much within the ambit of what the Constitution precludes. As Justice Robert Jackson said in Barnett, if there's any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it is that no official high or petty can prescribe what shall be orthodox in politics, nationalism, religion, or other matters of opinion, or force citizens to confess by word or act their faith therein. Examples of speech mandates include, again, SEC's failed attempt to force manufacturers to say that their products contained conflict minerals, and now it's ESG disclosures and the SEC-approved NASDAQ board diversity rule. SEC is apparently a frequent offender and slow learner. Third come speech licenses. These include laws that require obtaining a license before engaging in speech, as well as rules that suspend your law or medical license, for example, if you engage in forbidden speech. New York laws requiring local school district approval of the curriculum of private Jewish schools are implicated here as well. This category also includes social media censorship, where your license to use the product is suspended if you engage in disfavored speech. Now, you might protest that these examples are not ones of soft executive power. These wolves, to borrow a phrase, come as wolves. And that may be so, but I think it's important to speak with clarity about the stakes here. Power is power when you are at the wrong end of the rifle. So what separates soft executive power from whatever you want to call the other kind is not the ultimate stakes or what the government is aiming to achieve. It's merely a matter of using different methods. Not every instance of suppressing speech is as blatantly unconstitutional as the Disinformation Governance Board. Soft power may even be worse in the sense that it's harder to fight, harder to prove, and easier for the government to get away with. Indeed, I dare say there are some in this room who brush away the monumental efforts of the Biden administration to squelch speech on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and other social media sites as merely the actions of private companies. Not so. When the government coerces a company with threats and the company responds by crushing private individuals, that is state action, and the First Amendment forbids it. Is every person who was ever canceled on social media a victim of state action? Maybe not. But without discovery into the government's unprecedented practices, we would never have uncovered how widespread the practice has been, how orchestrated it's been, and how far up the chain of command it goes. We know the background level of censorship these companies engaged in before 2021, and we know what they did in response to government pressure. This was not independent private action in many cases. Remember, the government cannot do indirectly through third parties what it cannot do directly. We have to hold that line. Otherwise, free speech is a dead letter, because the government has countless ways of influencing private parties to suppress your speech. And let's not forget, these companies were banning a lot of true speech at the government's behest, such as the scientific fact that naturally acquired immunity to COVID is at least as effective as vaccination, or the fact that the vaccines were not preventing transmission of the disease to third parties, which supposedly justified vaccine mandates. COVID really has brought out the worst in public policy. Take the new California law signed by Governor Newsom. Come January 1, you can turn a doctor into the Medical Board of California for saying supposedly false things about COVID. And how do we know what's false? Why, if it goes against the consensus, of course. But aside from not knowing what the consensus is at any one point in time, the consensus might just be wrong. As one of NCLA's clients points out, the standard of care early in the pandemic was intubation for those hospitalized with COVID. Our client fought that practice and refused to intubate his patients under intense pressure. And as it turns out, intubation killed people. When the practice changed over time, medical outcomes improved radically. But how can you change bad practices if you're punishing the speech and yanking the medical licenses of the scientific dissenters? Governor Newsom is not the only one trying to say false speech is not protected. Former President Obama, Senator Dick Durbin, and others have been saying that free speech doesn't protect false speech. But that's flat wrong. Free speech does protect false speech and must protect false speech, and politicians and bureaucrats who say otherwise are just trying to chill speech with which they disagree. If the government disagrees with some speech, it has all the resources necessary to counter that speech with more and better speech. It does not have the power to shut you down outside of a few familiar limited categories. Science crucially depends on the ability to exchange ideas freely without worry about government sanction. But the government has no right to police the truth. As Justice Jackson put it a couple years after Barnett, the very purpose of the First Amendment is to foreclose public authority from assuming a guardianship of the public mind through regulating the press, speech, and religion. In this field, every person must be his own watchman for truth, because the forefathers did not trust any government to separate the true from the false for us. Now, the panel's focus today is on soft executive power. But no one who is the recipient of this particular kind of government boot stomping on their face thinks there's anything soft about speech bans and mandates. Ask Barry Romerl, whom the SEC has gagged for nearly 20 years and can't tell the real story of what happened with Xerox's accounting practices. Ask Jay Bhattacharya and Martin Kulldorff, whose Great Barrington Declaration appears to have been the target of an orchestrated takedown by Anthony Fauci and Francis Collins. Ask Alex Berenson, who was kicked off Twitter at the direct behest of the Biden administration. Ask Dr. Tracy Hoag, who has recently received threats from other doctors eager to turn her in to the Medical Board of California for saying things like, maybe all kids don't need the COVID vaccine. Ask Mario Cerami, a lawyer in Connecticut, who has to police his own speech under 15 different categories where the state bar disallows derogatory comments by lawyers. Ask Federalist Media about its multi-year investigation and enforcement action by the Trump administration's NLRB, mind you, over Ben Domenech's joke tweet. Ask Lisa Melisse, who unsuccessfully fought the Consumer Product Safety Commission's practice of putting many of its safety standards behind paywalls, the modern equivalent of Caligula hanging ancient Roman laws high on posts. Ask Attorney Gordon Scheffler, who, as the CDC's nationwide eviction moratorium was crumbling in courts across the country, was told that he and his clients had to falsely inform tenants in writing that they were protected by the CDC's halt order, when in fact the order had already been deemed unenforceable in Tennessee and elsewhere. Finally, ask Dr. Scully, an oral surgeon in Rhode Island whose medical practice the government shuttered for some 6 months when he spoke out against the state's nonsensical COVID policies, which included prohibiting unvaccinated doctors with natural immunity from treating patients while simultaneously allowing vaccinated doctors with active, raging cases of COVID to go ahead and treat patients. I kid you not, that was the policy in Rhode Island. When the administrative state's policies descend into madness and rampant illegality, brave speech from individuals like these are what will keep the frontiers of freedom from being overrun. The New Civil Liberties Alliance stands with them, and I trust Federalist Society members will too.
Thank you. Mr. Ellis, you're up.
Thank you, Judge, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this important panel on a very timely topic. I thought I'd give a little bit of industry perspective on the question of whether executive soft power is a threat to free speech. And, you know, it's funny hearing Mark mention all of those individuals and institutions who were subject to censorship on social media platforms. I can't help but think if only they had known about Rumble. Because provided the effective enforcement of antitrust laws that prevent monopoly power from accumulating in one or a small number of big tech platforms that can collude with the government to suppress private speech, so long as those antitrust laws are in place and are enforced, there are free market alternatives that will provide different forums for individuals to still engage in free speech. And Rumble is a prime example of that. We have seen that there is a market opportunity for a free speech-centered platform. So I want to give a little bit of background about Rumble for those who may be unfamiliar. Rumble is a video sharing platform that is a competitor to YouTube. In fact, the company was created in response to trends at YouTube. The company's founder, Chris Pavlovsky, noticed that YouTube was increasingly favoring big creators, corporate-backed musicians, entertainers, at the expense of the small creators who had really been at the center of YouTube when the platform first began. So Rumble was created initially to help those small creators get their voice out, to better monetize their content. Fast forward to 2020, a Republican congressman, Devin Nunes, found Rumble during that summer. He called our CEO with a seemingly simple question: if I begin to upload content to Rumble, will people be able to find it when they type in my name? The answer was, of course. Like, what else would you expect to find when you type in a search for Devin Nunes, other than content that Devin Nunes produces and uploads to Rumble? But that wasn't the case on YouTube. On YouTube, if you type in the search query Devin Nunes, you would find CNN clips, MSNBC clips, people talking about Devin Nunes, criticizing him, but nothing by the actual creator, whose material you'd think would be the most relevant to a user typing in his name to the search bar. Devin Nunes led was the first major content creator to come over to Rumble in the American political space, but then led a movement of many others, and a platform that had 1 million users on average per month in the second quarter of 2020 grew to 31 million a year later. And in our most recently reported statistics, 78 million monthly active users in August of this year. The company recently went public through a SPAC transaction and is now listed on the NASDAQ exchange. And I think this is real evidence that there is a segment of the market large enough to support a free speech alternative to YouTube. There's a significant segment of the population. Our user statistics are roughly around 15% of YouTubes in the United States who are driven away by YouTube's arbitrary and heavy-handed censorship policies and their failure to stay neutral, to keep to the original principles of the platform and of the internet. Now, many people have hypothesized, well, you know, when any company, including Rumble, becomes large enough, it will fall subject to the same market pressures that have caused YouTube and other large social media platforms to begin to censor speech. I would argue that's really not the case. The market opportunity is what drives Rumble. The free speech mission is at the heart of that market opportunity. If we were to stray from that mission, as a first matter, it just isn't in our bones. It's not at the core of what we believe, but it would also destroy the platform's appeal to its audience. Recently, we put that commitment into action. We received a demand from the government of France to censor certain content, in particular content by Russian state-owned media organizations. Now, obviously, we do not endorse the content of Russia Today or Sputnik News, far from it. But our content policies were not violated by anything they had uploaded to the platform. There was no claim that our content policies were implicated by anything they had uploaded to the platform. So rather than submit to the hard executive power from the French government, the company made the decision to make the service unavailable in France. You know, France is a small part of our user base, or was a small part of our user base at the moment, less than 1%. But I think this action really shows that there is a market case for a free speech platform that will not give in to government demands or this soft power that Mark described. However, in order for a company like Rumble to be able to exist in the market, we have to be able to compete on a level playing ground. If there are only a small number of entrenched big tech platforms, it's very easy for them to become captured by regulators, by the executive branch, and succumb to those pressures that Mark described. And this really gets to the issue of market power. If there's a small number of platforms who have the market power and can engage in anti-competitive behavior, then a platform like Rumble can never get started, can never grow to become a free speech alternative to YouTube. So that's why, at the start of last year, Rumble sued Google for antitrust violations. I'll just give a brief description of the claims that are listed in our complaint, but Google, in short, has used its search dominance to steer traffic away from Rumble. A search for a video that exists on both Rumble and YouTube, if you were to upload the same content to both places, will always yield a YouTube result first, even if you include the word Rumble in your search query. And this is just one instance where Google's control of multiple choke points over the internet gives it coercive power to prevent new competitors from entering the market. Think about a company like Google that controls a dominant position in the search engine industry, in the App Store. There's only two App Stores, and Google has one of them, and in online advertising. So in short, if there is effective enforcement of antitrust laws, I would argue, that can allow platforms like Rumble to enter the market, grow big enough to compete effectively with larger social media platforms, then there can exist viable free market alternatives to possible government collusion with social media platforms. Again, the market opportunity is there. It remains only for platforms like Rumble and others to take advantage of it. Thank you.
Mr. Cohn, you're up.
Excuse me. Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to talk about this concept of soft censorship in a different context to illustrate that it isn't only these online presence and medical contexts where this is happening, but to talk about my area of expertise, which is a decade of fighting censorship on college campuses. The First and 14th Amendments combine to prohibit federal, state, and local governments from engaging in censorship. And there's US Supreme Court authority dating back five decades, holding that the First Amendment applies in full force at public institutions of higher education. But despite these inescapable legal truths, censorship, as this audience likely knows, occurs far too often at our public colleges and universities. And indeed, FHIR's latest data from 2022 in our Spotlight on Speech Codes report indicates that 12% of public institutions and 41% of private institutions have at least one policy that would violate the First Amendment. Now, I'm going to pause for just one quick second to say that before we go further, I want to note that the First Amendment doesn't apply at private institutions. But courts have found that when private institutions make promises, whether it's free speech or academic freedom or on something else, they're obligated under contract law to abide by those promises. So when I say that 41% of private institutions maintain policies that would violate the First Amendment, I am not making the claim that they would lose a First Amendment challenge, but just to say that their behaviors are incompatible with what the case law would require at public institutions. But one aspect of campus censorship that's often overlooked is how often the censorship doesn't trace its roots to a campus administrator, but instead traces directly back to edicts from outside government actors like the Department of Education, and in some instances that we'll discuss also the Department of Justice. So I'm honored to be here today with you on this panel, sharing my organization, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expressions, perspective on some of the most pernicious attempts to compel universities to engage in censorship, both public and private. Indirect censorship from the Department of Education has taken a few forms, many of which are in the context of overzealous enforcement of Title IX. One tactic that the Department of Education has used to force institutions to engage in censorship is its adoption of overbroad definitions of sexual harassment. Definitions that don't comply with the Supreme Court's carefully crafted definitions designed to make sure that our important efforts to protect from discrimination take place within the confines of free speech law. The Supreme Court set that standard in a case called Davis versus Monroe County Board of Education. And there they define what counts as student-on-student harassment. And they say that it has to target the victim on the basis of their real or perceived membership in a protected class. It has to be objectively offensive to a reasonable person. And then it also has to be sufficiently severe and pervasive to the extent that it would prevent the target from having equal access to one of the benefits or opportunities of the educational institution. So no doubt it's a high bar, but certainly as the case law demonstrates, unfortunately there are enough cases on either side where students were subjected to conduct that met that standard and the schools didn't do what they should have done and have been held accountable. And of course there are also cases where schools jumped the gun and censored speech that didn't meet those thresholds. But in 2013, to resolve a Title IX complaint against the University of Montana, the Department of Justice and the Department of Education entered into a resolution agreement with the institution that expressly rejected the Davis definition. Now, these sorts of agreements are typically only binding on the parties to the agreement, but this one was unique. It was accompanied by a findings letter that declared that the terms of the agreement provide a blueprint for how colleges across the country must handle sexual misconduct allegations. So in doing so, it signaled to the general counsels and legal departments of every institution of higher education in the country that failure to adopt policies consistent with the agreement could cost them all of their federal funds, which is, of course, the consequence for failing to abide by Title IX. So, of course, the blueprint's definition, and I say of course just as it should surprise none of us, was overwhelmingly, shockingly broad. They define sexual harassment as any unwelcome conduct of a sexual nature, full end stop, and then added including verbal conduct, so speech. And the letter then explicitly stated that the alleged harassment need not even be offensive to an objectively reasonable person of the same gender in the same situation, and that's a direct quote. And they said, so even if the listener takes offense to sexually related speech for any reason, no matter how irrationally or how unreasonably, the speaker may be punished. So by rejecting the reasonable person standard, the definition endangered both academic freedom and free speech to a degree we had not prior seen. The blueprint also required university employees to report protected speech up the chain and allowed for punishment before the completion of any investigations. And then also ordered schools to maintain lists of students who are accused, even if no wrongdoing was ever found. Now, this problem was then exacerbated in 2013 when the department issued an informal guidance document called a Dear Colleague Letter on the topic of retaliation. Most of the letter was innocuous and actually protected free speech by prohibiting people from retaliating for participating in these proceedings. But what raised our brows was that its assertion that the Department of Education also had the authority to award damages to complainants in these claims. So in the spring of 2013, the Department of Education decided that schools had to use this entirely open-ended definition of sexual harassment. Oh, and also we can award damages in similar contexts. So FHIR wasn't alone in recognizing that the Department of Education was improperly pressuring institutions to engage in censorship. Writing in the National Review in 2015, Senators Lamar Alexander and James Lankford cited the Department of Education's practices of insisting its Title IX guidance was binding on institutions as primary examples of government overreach here. And then in February 26th of 2015, in a letter by the two conservative appointees to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, Gail Herriot and Peter Kersenow, wrote a letter to Congress where they indicated, "We've noticed," and I'm going to quote here for a second, "a disturbing pattern of disregard for the rule of law at OCR. That office has all too often been willing to define perfectly legal conduct as unlawful," end quote. So Herriot and Kersenow's conclusion is worth considering in its entirety. So if you will indulge me for just one more minute, I'm going to read what they had to say. They said, "It's difficult for school districts, universities, and private citizens to combat OCR's unsound policies. One of OCR's frequently used tactics is to launch an investigation of a school that it has reason to believe is out of compliance with its announced policies. Federal agencies claim that investigations are less severe actions than suing in an institution outright. And although this is true up to a point, it's important to understand that OCR often takes years to complete an investigation. Years. The investigations are thus a punishment in and of themselves. And institutions must hire attorneys and staff and students available for interviews and produce voluminous records to OCR. The institutions suffer reputational harm of being branded as having engaged in tolerated racial discrimination or sexual harassment. When OCR finally offers institution a settlement in lieu of going to court, the institution frequently has no alternative but to accept." So the reasons why I'm talking about the Department of Education's activities in 2013 through 2015 is because the Department of Education is once again led by the same individual who was at the helm at that time. And literally to no one's surprise, once again the department is pushing an overly broad definition of sexual harassment, this time in its proposed, what would be binding, Title IX regulations that are pending now. So I think it also illustrates and underscores the point that this is not a new phenomenon that we have to grapple with, but a long-standing problem that has confronted us for at least the last decade and probably much longer. And with that, I want to thank the Federalist Society for inviting me to participate in this discussion today, and to all of you for listening to what I had to say. I'm honored to be on this panel and look forward to the rest of the discussion.
Thank you. I appreciate those remarks. Professor Armijo.
Well, I want to add my thanks to the thanks of my colleagues. I want to also thank the student volunteers. It is a very hard time of year for you all, especially if you're a law student. It's coming up on final exam time, so we know your time is valuable. So thank you all for helping with this great event. I think it makes sense for me to start to just kind of let everyone know where I'm coming from, what my priors are. I have a very firm negative conception of the First Amendment, which that just means that I always consider the government the first order threat to free expression. My strong default is that the government should lose more often than it wins. I think the cases where the First Amendment cases where the speaker wins are mostly right, and the cases where the government wins are mostly wrong. I've done some work for Randy May is here. I've done some work for the Free State Foundation, some academic commentaries. As the judge said, I've written in a current issue of the Cato Supreme Court Review, and I'm also a firm supporter of something called the Santa Clara Principles on Content Moderation, which recognize the risks when states and governments get involved in content moderation and call for some robust user rights around those practices. So those are kind of my priors. However, in short, in direct response to the question posed by the panel title, my answer to that question is mostly no, at least with respect to the exercises of soft power that you all have been hearing about today. And in support of that position, I'm going to make a couple points. First is that the relevant First Amendment precedents make a clear distinction here between government requests, which are government speech, and government threats, which raise possible First Amendment issues. And I'm going to try to defend that distinction as good and something that that the case law should try to preserve. And we should be very careful when we kind of move towards a theory that relies or implies on the idea that government is inherently coercive in this area. And my second point is that if we do kind of move towards a theory that accepts government coerciveness, or that the government is inherently coercive, that would do more First Amendment harm than good. And then if I have time, I'll just ask the question, why should we be particularly more worried about exercises of executive power versus exercises of legislative soft power? So point one, government has speech rights too, right? The relevant case here is from 1963. I'm sure most of you all know it. It's called Bantam Books versus Sullivan. The Rhode Island legislature there does two things. They write a criminal statute that criminalizes what they call obscenity aimed at juveniles. And they create an agency called the Rhode Island Commission to Encourage Morality in Youth to investigate this issue. And to communicate threats. The Rhode Island legislature gives the Rhode Island Commission to Encourage Morality in Youth the authority to make recommendations for criminal prosecutions to the Rhode Island Attorney General. And the Rhode Island Commission does that. It sends a threat letter to some private book publishers and wholesale distributors, publications that some of us know about or remember called One Peyton Place and One's the Bramble Bush. And when they send this threat, to no one's surprise, the bookstores that sell these books stop selling the books. So the publishers of these books say this violates our First Amendment right, and the court agrees. So several years later, and much more recently in 2015, when Judge Posner is writing about this area of First Amendment doctrine, he says that, quote, what matters is the distinction between attempts to convince and attempts to coerce. Or to put that a different way, the distinction between a request and a demand. Or to use the formulation that Marx just used, the government telling someone to shut up, or the government telling a platform to shut them up, which I think is government speech, or the government telling someone or a platform to shut up or else, or shut them up or else. So in my view, that is a distinction that the current doctrine recognizes and that it should recognize. So that's the rule that the Missouri plaintiffs have to build a legal theory around, right? How do they do it? In my view, the way that they try to do it is to try to say that the government's power makes it an inherently coercive collaborator, right? So in other words, the government is telling platforms, shut them up or else, And the "or else" is supplied not by an explicit threat, but by the fact that it's the government, right? So what do they say? If you look at the Missouri Second Amendment complaint, paragraph 3 talks about a phase of open collusion with the government. Paragraph 200 says the government has pressured, cajoled, and colluded the platforms. Paragraph 253 says the platforms and the government are in a, quote, ongoing, close, and continuing collaboration. So these are the allegations by the plaintiffs themselves, right? And I think it's fair to say that when you read those allegations, what they attempt to do is elide this distinction that I'm talking about exists in the current doctrine. The distinction between a request, which is government speech, and a demand, which creates a First Amendment problem. A demand that in the cases takes the form of legal threats. And in order to make this argument, what the Missouri plaintiffs point to is government speech that looks nothing like a threat at all, right? So you have Jen Psaki talking about disinformation on Facebook. You have an online petition by the Biden-Harris campaign, legislative statements, which I said I may talk about in the end if I have some time. This is all in furtherance of a conspiracy to silence private speakers. Ask yourself, by the way, if a conspiracy can take place in public. Usually when we think about conspiracies, those take place in private. So let me go back to the 2015 case that was written by Judge Posner, Backpage versus Dart. So there, the government threat consists of a sheriff. A county sheriff says that, writes a letter to credit card companies that they are, by permitting payments to Backpage.com, and I think most of us remember what Backpage.com is, that those credit card companies were, quote, willfully aiding and abetting sex trafficking and engaging in criminal money laundering. That's what Judge Posner says is a shut up or else demand that implicates the First Amendment. If a government threat on that level surfaces in discovery in the Missouri case, if a shut up or else threat is discovered in that case, I will eat the notes to this talk on TikTok. Why am I so sure that these threats will not appear? Because the government here that's making these alleged threats has admitted that this speech is protected. When Jen Psaki stood up and said that there's disinformation on Facebook and that Facebook should take it down, she acknowledged that that speech was protected. Furthermore, we can have differences of opinion about what Section 30 should be, right? But I think it's clear that Section 30 would protect the or else part of the shut them up or else threat that anyone in the government would make against a platform. So in other words, there's no basis on which to threaten the platform to take down the speech, at least a legal threat as the type the case law currently recognizes. So in a case that has no explicit government threat, as I've said, or what the Second Circuit in applying the same area of First Amendment law says, quote, government comments that are reasonably susceptible to a threatening interpretation, I would say, and this comes to my second point, I think it would be bad, normatively bad, as we say in the business, for the First Amendment to recognize a claim that comes short of an explicit threat of legal action. Why? We want to know what the government's position is with respect to these issues. The government has every right to engage in counter speech. The government has every right to talk about experts as to what effective counter speech would be. And as private individuals, we want to know when the government is doing that. We want to know if Joe Biden thinks Facebook is killing people. We want to know if Dr. Fauci thinks that the signatories of the Great Barrington Declaration are fringe. So if these acts of what I would call pure government speech are facts that go to a conspiracy of censorship that can give someone a First Amendment claim to punish the government for doing them, that will chill government speech. So in every other area of the First Amendment, we say that if there's a threat, the prospect of liability chills speech. So if we have a First Amendment rule that moves from legal threats of government process are actionable to a rule that says government coercion is enough, that's going to be a First Amendment problem because we will know less about what the government thinks. I also think that this right, this conception of executive soft power as giving rise to a First Amendment claim is not administrable. I think it's subject to abuse. At the risk of being slightly provocative, which I think is okay because we all believe in the First Amendment, right? I must ask the question why we're worried about this now. October 2017, President Trump says NBC FCC licenses should be revoked because they spread fake news. September 2018, President Trump says CNN licenses should be revoked for spreading fake news. They don't have any licenses. Does that matter? So does a mistake of fact a defense for the government? 2019, the President Trump talks about Amazon Washington Post and the Department of Defense in response cancels a contract for cloud computing. Do we have to wait for the government, for the Department of Defense to actually cancel that contract, or do we permit Amazon to bring the claim as soon as the president makes the threat? In May 2020, Twitter labels a President Trump tweet. Very shortly thereafter, the FTC is directed in an executive order to interpret Section 230 narrowly. So did those two acts occur close enough in time that we can infer causation between the threat and the adverse employment action, or you might say the connection between the executive soft power and the act of executive hard power? We don't even have time to talk about what happened in Florida to Walt Disney World, right? But I think if we just had a panel at this conference that says, what should we do about woke corporations? I think at least some people might not be as worried about that with respect to the First Amendment as I might be. This was not a topic at the last few conferences. It's a topic today. I think it's fair to ask why. And I think the reason why is because this theory, again, moving from a shut up to shut up or else legal theory that permits First Amendment claims, I think it's subject to abuse. And again, I think it's going to result in us knowing less about what the government thinks because the government will be disinclined to speak. Let me just say a little bit about legislative soft power. And you have to put aside speech and debate clause issues because that's an issue, right? That would have to be litigated. But we have Senators Cruz, Lee, and Hawley threatening Major League Baseball's antitrust exemption because of what Major League Baseball says about Georgia voting bills. You've got Senator Hawley again threatening Disney copyright protections because he says Disney is too woke. Tom Cotton 2 weeks ago says that GM better be careful about canceling its advertising on Twitter because they don't like something that Elon Musk may have done or what something Elon Musk might do. These are all acts of legislative power and in some cases combined with legislative hard power that I think are much greater threats to the First Amendment than Jen Psaki giving comments at a news conference about what the government thinks about disinformation. So I'll just close by saying I think we should be careful about letting the First Amendment do so much work with respect to what the government can and can't say. Because if we do let the First Amendment do more work in that area, we're going to know less about what the government thinks. Thank you.
Thanks very much. I think we're obviously set for a great conversation. I'll follow that up by putting the first question to you, Mark. Obviously, not to get into your disagreements about the state of the evidence in your particular litigation, but do you agree or disagree with the professor about the fact that there's a line between convincing and coercing, and that should be a relevant legal line?
I'm a big fan of Judge Posner. I had him as a student. But the joke about Judge Posner was that he comes up with distinctions that only work when Judge Posner applies them. And I think that we may have one of those here. I'm not sure I do. I mean, if you were to talk about, is there some distinction between those two things? Yes, there is. I will note that the examples that Enrique gave were from the complaint, which was pre-discovery. So we have a lot better examples of what took place now that we've had some amount of discovery. We have multiple depositions still to be taken. But even the emails that we've gotten so far, many of which are still not public, show much greater levels of coercion. So I think even if I were to accept that distinction, I think we could be on the coercion side of the distinction in this case. I do think there's a role for the bully pulpit, right? The word bully is in bully pulpit, right? There is room for the president or other people in the executive branch to try to cajole. I think that's acceptable. I don't think that's what was going on here. And I think that the idea that you would chill government speech is laughable. First of all, there's sovereign immunity, there's qualified immunity, there are all sorts of doctrines that protect the government in these situations. So, just count me as someone who's not worried at all about hearing less from the government about what the government wants to tell us. I'm pretty sure that they'll continue to share their views.
Michael, I was curious what kind of, you've obviously taken a different tack with your company, looking at the antitrust aspect of it. What kind of damages have you all requested in your lawsuit? I'm curious how the damages flow from the particular behavior.
Yeah, so the damages that we allege result from traffic being steered to versions of videos on YouTube instead of Rumble. So essentially, the way that the online advertising market works, when a video appears on YouTube, if Rumble has uploaded that video to YouTube, or any creator, that they receive a small cut of the advertising revenue after YouTube and the Google Ad Network take their percentages. If a viewer watches a video on Rumble itself instead of on YouTube, then we receive a significantly higher portion of the ad revenue, even if we are using Google Ad Network to serve the ad on that video. So it's the delta between the revenue that we actually received from impressions of videos on YouTube, and what we would have received if not for Google's anti-competitive conduct to steer the traffic away from our platform.
And are you seeking financial remedies in response to those damages, or something else?
We're seeking both both an injunction to get Google to stop it, but also monetary damages. We estimate those to be $2 billion. Which would be trebled in an antitrust suit, but we'll find out more in discovery. I should add that Google's motion to dismiss was denied this past summer, so we're just starting the discovery process now to see what the true extent of the damages are.
Excellent, thank you. Yeah. One thing that caught my ear, also back to you, Mark, was the discussion of some of the speech related to medical care. Is the distinction between speech and conduct something that you all have tangled with, and how would you draw that line? And then I'd be honestly interested to hear if any of the other panelists have a response to that question as well.
Sure, and if you want my whole take on that, you can. I've got an article in the Cato Supreme Court Review about the Expressions Hair Design case from the Supreme Court a few years ago that talks a little bit about the speech conduct distinction. Where we've run into that is let me think. Not so much. That may prove to be an issue in the California litigation. We'll see. I had an example when you were asking the question, and it's escaped me. So I'll come back to you with.
My microphone is off and on. I'll flesh it out. One question that came to mind was, do you see, in terms of understanding the contours of your argument, do you see it as different to ban someone from saying that a medical procedure is harmful versus banning someone from performing a medical procedure that some board, right, wrong, or otherwise, concludes is harmful? Do you see a distinction, or do you think that those two are also intertwined?
I do see a distinction between the two. I think what happens oftentimes is, and I talked about this at the beginning of my talk, this free speech shortcut or the shut up shortcut. I think it's much more difficult for the government to prove that someone's conduct is illegal in many cases. And the example I was thinking about that I forgot temporarily is the example of asking about someone's salary history. It's relatively easy for the government to prove that you ask someone about their salary history. It's much more difficult for the government to prove that you use their salary history against them in a discriminatory way. So the government wants to prohibit you from asking the question to make it easier for the government to prosecute you. And that's what we're seeing over and over and over and over again across every regulatory agency, basically, that they're trying to do these speech regulations because it makes it easier on the government to prosecute. And so what happens is these speech crackdowns are often adjunct to other rights violations. But I do think there's a speech conduct distinction. And the example I used, I think you'd have a hard time saying that the government can't have a rule that you can't use someone's salary history against them in a discriminatory way. I think that rule probably survives judicial review. But I think that the rule that you can't ask someone what their salary history is, I think you have a much tougher time with that. It's gone both ways in different courts.
Joe, what do you think about this limitations on questions? I imagine that might be something that's come up. Where can you go with that from your work?
Well, I'm sorry, on the limitations?
The limitation on what questions can or can't be asked by whom. I know there have certainly been some due process issues raised in some of the types of cases that you've talked about.
Yeah, I think that most instances when you have a gag order, you're under shaky ground. And whether it's gag orders on declaring certain things or asking particular questions, either way, you're in similarly constitutionally suspect circumstances. Now, I think that it's easier in my context to say where does it go from speech to conduct, because the Supreme Court provided the formula. They said it switches to conduct when you meet this test in Davis. Less has been said specifically, to the best of my knowledge, in the medical profession, of exactly where it goes from speech into conduct. Now, the statute, in my view, attempts to make the distinction, and I'll leave it to Mark or others to decide whether or not they do it sufficiently well enough, by limiting its prescription on what could be said distance information in the context of the care provided to the patient, someone in the care of the patient. So theoretically, that same doctor who thinks that the standard of care is crazy can write a law review article or the Washington Post or go on Rumble with the video and say, you know, their standard of care is crazy and we need to change it. So the government isn't specifically issuing an across-the-board gag order, but they're saying you're engaging in conduct when you're giving advice to your patient. Now, I'm going to let Mark decide whether or not that's sufficient enough, but I think that's how they're trying, at least in the statute, to make that distinction.
It looks like we've already got some folks ready to ask questions, but before we do that, I'll give our panelists a chance. If you have a question that came to mind during any of your co-panelist remarks, I'd be happy to give you an opportunity to pose that question. That goes for any of you.
I had a question for Michael. I'm a huge free market proponent. Fan of Rumble. Cloudflare is another company out there that has a similar sort of free market approach to cloud-based storage, I guess, in their case. And that's great, but what about when the government does threaten Twitter? I mean, we've seen that since Elon Musk has taken over, the government has directly threatened Twitter's new pro-free speech policy numerous times. And Hillary Clinton has even persuaded the European Union to try to crack down on Twitter over its new free speech policy. So I guess my question is, what do you do then? I mean, it seems to me that the example of France shows that companies will cave to government power.
Well, if we were actually faced with a coercive government demand to censor certain speech, we'd be running to the courthouse, right? I perhaps took it as a given and should have explained more that underlying all of this is a robust protection of First Amendment rights in U.S. courts, right? That the First Amendment, well, in fact, that we will be able to litigate on those grounds and will prevail in the face of government attempts to enact prior restraints against us, right? Or to compel certain speech from the company. I think many of the examples that have been discussed in the news with Twitter, we'll see what the government actually does. If they were to actually mandate a certain content moderation policy, I'm sure Twitter would have a great First Amendment claim. And I think actually the Elon Musk acquisition of Twitter does provide further evidence of the points I was making about there is actually a market demand for a more pro-free speech platform, right? That there is an opportunity here that Elon Musk, a very smart guy, saw and took advantage of. And I think that shows that the prior Twitter content moderation policies were rejected by by a chunk of the market, and this is a natural response to it. So, but yes, to your point, if we have an actual, you know, government demand, take the speech down, or we issue you a fine, then we'll be litigating.
Soft executive power. Soft executive power is when the government says, now that you've announced this free speech policy, we're going to give you a proctological exam over here in this other area, right? That's what's happening. The FTC isn't going to go after directly on free speech. They're going to go after something else because they don't like the company's direction there. We see that with bank examinations, for example, now. That was what Operation Choke Point was about. I mean, it's not the government coming into a bank and saying, you can't have company X as a customer of this bank. It's them coming in and saying, boy, it sure seems like your client risk level has gone up here. And gosh, if your client risk level continues to go up, we're really going to have to fail you on this bank examination. Banks aren't stupid. They know when their regulator's threatening them. And that's the other problem we were talking about, between the coercion and cajoling line. Maybe it's cajoling if it's coming from the president or someone, but if it's coming from your regulator who directly regulates you, believe me, companies don't treat that as being cajoled.
I think this does come back to that cajoling versus coercion line that Professor Armijo also described in his remarks. And there's a point. These will be fact-specific determinations, I suppose. But when the cajoling crosses the line to coercion. But again, I think in the prominent social media examples, it has been, absent what you pull out of the hat in discovery. It appears from the press reporting to be in the convincing or cajoling line side of that line.
All right. Well, okay. Well, we'll take your generosity for the first question. I will remind everyone. I'm sure that none of you would do this, but it's very important to make sure that you have questions rather than comments, so that we can make sure that we can hear the answers from all of our great panelists. So please introduce yourself and let us know what your question is.
Todd, is this on? Can you hear me? Yeah, there. Todd Zwicky from Scalia Law. Brief question for Michael, and then a larger question for the others. Michael, I'm sure I'm not the only one thinking about Parler, and want to know sort of what has happened with sort of the infrastructure of all this, so that you guys don't get parlorized. If you can just speak to that, and then for the other panelists, my observation is what this really comes back to is the lawlessness of the regulatory state. What the regulatory state can do is so unconstrained by law, it's so vague, it has such expansive powers. And what it looks like to me, you're describing, and certainly what's going on in the banking context, is that they're acting strategically. They're figuring out where the line is. They're going right up to the line where they think they won't get their head handed to them in a court. And doing exactly that. So they're basically taking Professor Armijo's advice of how to make this look like it's not illegal content when they know behavior when they know exactly what it is. Thanks.
Yeah, so to get to the Parler example, and I'm glad that you brought that up, Rumble is building its own infrastructure, and we intend over the next year to have a commercial cloud offering as well, to other platforms that are concerned about cancel culture, are concerned about similarly being deplatformed by a cloud provider. I think there also are, I should add, good arguments for some degree of common carrier regulation in this area, as exists in more traditional telecommunications fields as you go farther down the tech stack. But Rumble's answer to that is to build the infrastructure ourselves and do everything we can to eliminate that risk.
I have one response to what Professor Zwicky said, which is, I do think that part of the problem here is that the process is the punishment, and this goes back to something that Joe was saying, quoting Gail Heriot and Peter Kersenow, that most people knuckle under, right? So if you have to go to court to defend and say, what side of the line your conduct's on, most people aren't going to do that because they can't afford to do it. It's not worth it to them to do it. But that doesn't mean that their constitutional rights haven't been violated.
Uh-oh.
Just there it is. Okay. Hi, Tyler Herman from the Columbus Lawyers Chapter. This was mentioned in passing actually at last year's Lawyers Convention, so this is to any of you who might have a thought. A comparison to the private search doctrine under the Fourth Amendment, where a landlord can go into your apartment when they want, right? But if the police go to the landlord who, and the police don't have the authority to go in at that time and say, hey, next time you're in there, could you look for drugs and then tell us if you find them? That otherwise perfectly fine action of the landlord going in now is a problem. Is there any, do you see any analogy there between the government who could not censor going to Twitter and saying, hey, just so you know, that's a misinformation. We can't take it down, but you should. Thanks.
I guess I'll just weigh in real quickly and say that there are certainly cases about entanglement between government actors and private actors that talk about when the private actor is being used as an agent. So, you know, when there's just a request, but a request to do something that the government couldn't be done, where there's an agreement to then do it further, you know, that has to be looked at in, you know, specific basis to see if it presents the kind of entanglement. I think, you know, I do, however, agree that the government should still be able to always express its point of view. So I think there are really three different areas. You can say, you know, the government thinks this is disinformation. Full end stop, that's the end of the statement. Then they can say, the government thinks this is disinformation and we really wish that all the social media companies would make sure that it never sees the light of day. No, necessarily, still in the request line to, you know, and the cajoling to some. And then it could say, you know, we think this is disinformation. We really think it would be a shame if you private actors didn't suppress it. And gosh, it would be a shame if something happened to your whatever license, whatever, you know. And I think that there's consensus that the third is completely off of the table constitutionally. But I also think that the middle one has significant problems because of the entanglement, because it does also, you know, you put the private actor in the position of figuring out with the 300-pound gorilla whether or not there really is an implied threat or not, what else is being requested of them, and the request of them is really, it gets into that entanglement question if they decide and agree to do it.
What about the statement, Facebook is killing people, and a behind-the-scenes threat that we're going to continue to say Facebook's killing people until you pull down this disinformation off of your website? Or why hasn't Alex Berenson been taken off of your platform yet?
Yeah,
I mean, you could argue that's not coercion, I guess.
Yeah, I'm inclined to find more coercion in the fact patterns and don't think that there's an easy, exact, bright line.
I guess one follow-up that I would have for you, Mark, is it seems that a lot of your examples are focused on information that you think is not harmful. Do you have a different view for information that everyone would agree is harmful? Do you think that there's a distinction there? Is the problem that the government is drawing the line, or that there's a line at all?
Well, unfortunately, as is often the case in the free speech area, the good comes with the bad. So, you know, I don't think that the standard's different for the false speech. But I do think it's instructive that the government didn't draw a distinction between the true speech and the false speech. And our clients in particular, I mean, whether you're talking about the Great Barrington Declaration or you're talking about the fight to recognize natural immunity, I mean, the government was systematically punishing truthful speech in order to advance government purposes like vaccine mandates. Because if people had full information about the fact that the vaccine wasn't preventing transmission to third parties, I think that would have undermined the public health case, or the government thought it would undermine the public health case for widespread vaccination mandates. And of course, remember with vaccine mandates, the government said, well, we didn't mandate them. Right? Because they didn't, at least the CDC didn't, it just recommended it. And then if you tried to go to say, oh, I'll just pick an example, Michigan State University, which we're suing, and say, hey, you have this policy that doesn't seem rational. Well, what did the district judge say in our case? Well, it was rational for the university to follow the recommendation of CDC. So you can't sue CDC because that wasn't final agency action, or it was just a recommendation, it wasn't a mandate, and you can't sue the university because they're just following, they're reasonably following a recommendation. That's the kind of thing, I know, I realize that's not a free speech example, but there are examples like that in the free speech area too, where the government is playing this very sophisticated game of avoiding legal responsibility for the conduct that it's engaging in. And that's the whole problem with soft executive power.
Leave Europe.
Francis Hoare, I'm a public law barrister from London. Does the panel agree that the, in answer to the question Judge Grant asked about the distinction between free speech and conduct, that one should go back to John Stuart Mill and others and say that when one is speaking as a clinician or as a scientist about medical or scientific issues which can brook no conclusive answer because by definition they are scientific and medical disagreements, there is a very clear distinction between that on the one hand and on the other, the judge's example, which is the clinician doing a form of medical intervention that has very little support. In English law, we have the Bolan principle and the Bellido principle, which is essentially if you are performing a medical procedure, then you have to have the support of a reasonable body and rational body of medical professionals. That is not the case and should not the case be the case, does the panel agree, with free speech and speech about controversial elements of medical practice and scientific belief. Because by definition, you can only get to a conclusion or to a moderate belief and consensus by having debate and by raising thoroughly unorthodox ideas, which might appear at the beginning to be wrong, but you may discover after much experiment and debate that they are not.
I think I agree with you. I mean, yeah. So, go ahead.
So I'm heartened to have another million in the room. I wonder if we are currently in a million utopia or a million nightmare. I mean, if you take Mill to his natural conclusion, then I wonder if we are ever going to get to an objective truth about anything. So in other words, if every single idea helps get us closer to the truth, and therefore every idea must be expressed, I think that's close to where we are now, and I think Mark and I would agree that that's, you know, on balance a good thing. And if I just, I guess this is more responsive to Todd's point at the beginning, so I'm sorry I didn't jump in, but so the idea of a government disinformation governance board, right? You have a continuum, I guess, and I would be on the continuum that is stupid. I guess Mark would be on the continuum of this is something that should keep you awake, right? There are reasonable kind of places on that continuum that all of us could land. I would never ask that on a First Amendment exam because there's no standing, right? The fundamental problem is that when the government engages as an actor in these million debates, it's an open question as to what the actual harm in permitting the government to do that actually causes individual speakers.
To get back to the medical example, so if you had a doctor in California, for example, who said, you know, you should inject bleach in your veins in order to cure COVID or something like that. And then suppose the doctor actually did that, injected, obviously this is a counterfactual, but injected bleach in someone's arm or something to combat COVID. The medical malpractice laws would be in play against that person, absolutely. I mean, that's just, it's not anywhere close to the standard of care, it's unreasonable conduct, et cetera. But I'm worried a little bit about, because of the intubation example I gave, right? So at the time that our client was refusing to intubate his patients, he was being told that doesn't meet the standard of care, you have to intubate. And he fought that and was able to not intubate his patients, and he turned out to be right, but he could have been wrong, right? So I want to agree with you, but I don't think the example is completely clean.
There's a distinction, though, between engaging in a medical procedure on the one hand and refusing to engage in a medical procedure
I agree with
on
that.
The other.
I do, yeah. First, do no harm.
All right, I believe you're up. Okay.
So you say there is no or else. Let me give a quote from the chair of the House Subcommittee on Communication Technology to the CEOs of Google, Facebook, and Twitter. You can take this content down, you choose not to, but time after time you're picking engagement and profit over the health and safety of your users. It seems like you shrug off billion-dollar fines. Your companies need to be held accountable. To me, that's a pretty clear or else. And when they raise questions of removing 230 protection from these companies or antitrust liability, there's a lot of threats being made against these companies if they don't censor this speech that they're being told by the government to censor. At least my thoughts on that. So I was wondering if you could, your own thoughts on that.
That happens every single day. So what are we going to do, right? When you have an individual legislator who's showing off for their 3 minutes on C-SPAN, and they make a threat that's exactly like that one, which again happens every single day in each House of Congress. Is every single one of those statements, put aside the speech or debate immunity, because I think the fact that there's speech or debate immunity should make us more worried about those statements, right? Is every one of those threats, the threat alone, and I'll concede that they are threats, right? Although I actually said that we probably shouldn't think about them as threats. If every one of those statements gives rise to a First Amendment claim, we have a problem with respect to the First Amendment, right? And I do think that would have a chilling effect if every one of those statements would give rise to a First Amendment claim against a legislator. Now, there are ways to get around that, right? Or feel better about the fact that the answer is no, right? No one legislator can pass a law, right? That's why we feel okay about Senator Lee and Senator Hawley and Senator Cruz challenging these companies for what they say. But I think we really do run the risk of First Amendment, and as I said at the beginning, I'm a strong libertarian on the First Amendment, but I think we would run into lots of governance problems, and those are the kind of problems I'm talking about, governance problems, if we First Amendment-ify everything.
Judge Rao made the point, I think it was at this conference last year, but I've heard her speak a few times, it may have been somewhere else in the last year, that the lowliest bureaucrat at a lot of these agencies can actually pass a law, that they can introduce a notice of proposed rulemaking, and they can push it all the way through, and it becomes a law, and it rules and regulations are binding on people too. So, I do worry about the coercive effect when these things come from the executive branch, from regulators, especially from your regulator.
But let me just, if I can, that rule is always susceptible to an as-applied challenge, right? You always have the option, if you do in fact have a regulation or a law that violates your First Amendment right or that was passed in retaliation over something that you said, so long as you have preserved that, right, preserved that challenge, you're free to make that challenge in court.
I think that's what, that was my response to this question earlier as well, right? If we had a demand from a regulator that was pretextual, right, to use Mark's example. And I certainly agree with Mark that it can be difficult to suss out what the pretextual demands are. And this gets to, I think, one of the questioner's points about the lawlessness of the administrative state, right, that when there's so many different threads to pull, it can be difficult to isolate out when there is retaliation. That can be difficult, like a fact-intensive inquiry. But I agree with Professor Armijo that it's, in that situation, you have a remedy to sue for the retaliatory conduct by the government official. The statements by legislators, both that the questioner read and that Professor Armijo read before from, in the opposite direction, they aren't really that, right? They're hot air from legislators.
And it just, if I could just say one more thing, imagine a scenario in which this panel's over and Michael goes back to his desk and he has two voicemails. One is from me, and one is from Brendan Carr at the FCC. Michael would be a fool to call me back first, right? There's no world in which he would do that. That by itself, the fact that these private companies are more responsive to the government than they are to private parties, the fact that Twitter or Facebook has a specific place where they can report what they think are violations of terms of service, and I don't get to report my violation to that specific place, I guess that's superficially problematic, but that's just the way the world works, right? That in itself is not enough to raise our, at least I'm arguing, to be that concerned about the First Amendment, the fact that these processes exist.
Well, and to the extent that you don't like a platform that has a process for the government to report conduct differently than private citizens to report conduct, then you have a choice in platforms.
Joe, it looks like you had a response too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's also reason to be concerned not just about the First Amendment legal question of whether or not the First Amendment has been violated, but on the normative level in terms of what it means for free speech, because really what this requires, and I don't necessarily disagree in some of the contexts that have been discussed today, is for these private entities to have courage and to say no. Oh yeah, you wanted to have there be a consequence? I'm telling you no, and then to challenge it. And I think that, you know, we would be fools not to also recognize the amount of courage that that requires, and that a lot of private actors won't exhibit it. So in terms of its implications on being in a free society where people can speak their minds, there are tremendous implications when the government engages in many of these behaviors. I don't necessarily think that all of them give rise to a winning First Amendment lawsuit the first time a politician, you know, opens their mouth and you know, engages in this kind of behavior.
Hi, my name is Gidalia Melian. I'm not an attorney. I'm very much interested in the law because obviously it affects all of us. And
can you speak up slightly?
Oh, sure. My name is Gidalia Emelian. I am not an attorney, but I'm very much interested in what happens with the law because obviously it affects all of us. And my question is, when it comes to free speech, and we have a small group of companies that obviously owns all of these social media apparatus, for example, you have Mark Zuckerberg, which is under the umbrella of Facebook, Instagram, and also WhatsApp. Why is it that we are not using the same regulations that we did during the time that we had the same issues with AT&T, being that now social media is the public square?
Well, I mentioned Rumble's antitrust lawsuit against Google, you know, I don't, and certainly again, as I described, there are choke points in the digital economy that that these big tech platforms control, and I think there does need to be a serious examination as to whether there has been effective enforcement of the antitrust laws in this context over the past several decades. But it's a great question, but one that I think we need a whole other panel to really delve into.
Professor Hamburger would love your suggestion.
I'll just say in response to that, if you are happy when Elon Musk bought Twitter, then you believe platforms have First Amendment rights, full stop. There's no other First Amendment, there's no other position that you could have with respect to the First Amendment right of platforms to associate and speak through content moderation that is consistent. That has to be your position. Why were you happy when Elon Musk bought Twitter? Because Elon Musk has ideas and beliefs about rights of speech and association that you share.
But there isn't a First Amendment right to Section 230 protection.
Well, and therefore
it could be repealed.
I'm not sure what that has to do with the fact that
it would change the behavior of the platforms because they would no longer have exemption from liability. I mean, that's one of the games that the government plays, is to create liability for speech and then turn the plaintiff's bar loose on different folks. One of the reasons why the tech industry was able to take off was because it was exempt from all of that threat from the plaintiff's bar for decades. And if that threat goes back into place, which every other company in America has to deal with, by the way, then I think they would behave a little bit differently.
Well, we could debate
that's
about
another panel.
Yeah. All I'm saying is that you could repeal Section 230, and Elon Musk would still be protected from the government with respect to what he decides is and isn't on Twitter.
I'm going to be really minimalist in my contribution here, which is to say that what you're asking is the Super Bowl question of free speech for the next, you know, however many years that will determine a heck of a lot in terms of how people feel their ability to communicate with each other. FHIR hasn't yet staked out a position on that, and we're engaging in the internal debate, so I hesitate to put my own personal cards on the table today.
Hi, my name is Michael Aguilero, student at the University of Maryland School of Law. I was wondering if the panel had any opinions as to at what point does declaring a platform to be a common carrier become effectively nationalizing the platform?
I think that's probably, again, yet another panel, but if anyone has a fast answer, I'm happy to.
I mean, the quick answer is that's a tough question about whether these platforms, you know, should be treated as common carriers, but you know, we have applied common carrier regulations to a number of other industries, right? Telecommunications industry, I don't think we'd say we've, you know, nationalized the cell phone industry because cell phone companies are common carriers.
And I would just say that Texas and Florida have passed statutes that attempt something in this direction. I think the Texas statute's better than the Florida statute for someone who approves of that approach to it, but the Supreme Court will have an opportunity to judge one of those statutes, at least I think in the near future. I don't know if it's going to choose to do so.
All right.
Hi, I'm Casey Maddox. I'm VP for Legal and Judicial at Americans for Prosperity. And I wanted to kind of move us back to a little bit more of the solution, how to solve the problem, and maybe without, you know, kind of the fundamental impacts on the platforms themselves, for example. And that, so I've, you know, heard suggestions, several different people suggesting the idea that what we need is, if, you know, on the easier side, perhaps the platforms themselves just decide the government can attempt to cajole, persuade, whatever, but the government needs to know that every time we receive those requests, we're going to make that very public. And so if we are getting a phone call from someone at the FTC, we're going to thank them for that phone call, and we're going to put that on a dedicated site that says, this is a request from this person at this agency asking us to do the following, and this is the action we took or did not take with respect to that request. So that's the, you know, Elon Musk just decides, I'm going to create this database and make it publicly available, and we'll put everything up within 24 hours of any demand we get. The other possibility is that that Congress decides, look, we need to deal with this problem. We didn't tell this agency to go pressure these social media platforms, for example. And so we're going to tell you from now on that you need to keep the log and make publicly available, the agencies do, every time you're making a demand of a platform. You don't get to ask these things privately. And so if you want to use your speech, if the government wants to engage in its own First Amendment, I would say it's not the government's First Amendment rights, because the government doesn't get rights. It has obligations and it has powers. It doesn't get rights. But setting that aside, if the government wants to engage in its own speech activity, great. Make sure that's loud. Make sure we can all hear it. And I'm curious, those are possible other answers that you would suggest for how to deal with at least making sure that we all know what are these pressures that the government is causing.
I could reply real quickly, because I can be quick on this one, which is I think that transparency has to be part of the solution, regardless of what we think about the other aspects of it. And I think back to the context of the recently reported on election integrity partnership between Homeland Security and a lot of the big tech entities, where the government was flagging content that it viewed as disinformation and suggesting to the social media companies that they might want to remove it. And they were careful to make a few claims. One was that we did it out in the open, so it wasn't in secret. And two, that they never demanded, they only asked. But those were the two arguments, you know, that were presented. And I think that, you know, while it may have been hiding in plain sight, Casey, your suggestion of more visibility, I think, is a helpful part of it, even if it might be insufficient as an answer.
I think we might actually have a lot of common ground up here on this issue. That what I talked about at the beginning about the Santa Clara principles of content moderation say exactly that the government should be transparent when it's giving, you know, asking platforms to take down content, and if your content got taken down and the government requested that your content get taken down and you were taken down, the platform should tell you that, right? I mean, I don't think, you know, Mark should have the evidence already that he needs. You know, I don't think he should have to depose Jen Psaki under oath to see what else she said other than what she said.
Might be fun,
up on the podium. Right, right. Let me just say one more thing. I would hate for people to walk away from this panel, and maybe Michael's a better person to give the actual data behind this point, but I would hate for people to walk away from this panel and think that platforms don't say no to the government. Because they say no to the government all the time, in all kinds of contexts. So it's not the case that the government says, I think you should take something down, and then the platform goes and runs and finds some pretextual reason to do that and say, we agree that this violates the terms of service.
Well, I don't have any data on the point of you know, just how many times platforms say no, but again, I to get back to some of my initial remarks, I think the reason that a platform like Rumble has seen the success that it has to date in attracting a user base is because of arbitrary and heavy-handed content moderation policies by the big tech platforms. Whether that was done at the behest of the government or, you know, generated internally, I don't know. But the result is the same, and the fact that there's now a market pressure in the opposite direction, right, for platforms that don't take a similar approach and you know, stake their mission around saying no to the government when the government makes an unlawful demand, I think is a heartening development.
I do have some data on this point, and it was reported in the back and forth exchange with that EIP agreement partnership, you know, that I was describing, in which it was reported that of the tickets, and they use that phrase, the tickets is what was submitted from a government actor in the partnership to flag for potential, you know, removal, the big tech industry responded to 75% of those requests. And now responsive doesn't tell you how they responded, but the data goes further. And it says that that they actually removed the content 35% of the time. Now, you will all be independent judges about whether or not 35% of the time demonstrates that they were willing to say no to it a majority of the time, so therefore nothing to see here. Or if you take the opposite view that X number of times, 33% of the time, when the government asked for someone to be silenced with a restraint, the private entity decided to do it, and therefore there's a big problem here. And I think reasonable minds could make arguments either way.
Looks like we have our last question.
So Joe may have actually addressed in part my question, because I've heard a lot of debate here about, well, is this coercion or is this coercion? And are we going to find that smoking gun in the emails? Well, that's what litigation is all about, right? That's what we do all the time in litigation. We try and find that smoking gun. Most of the time we don't. So we try it to a jury and we let the jury decide, is there coercion? Isn't that really the role of the jury to decide if there's coercion and hence liability? And isn't that what Joe is suggesting? Is that right or wrong?
I mean, I think that's largely right. I'd have to unpack it a little bit further, because I certainly don't want to take off of the table that there might need other interventions, or definitively say now that other interventions are wise or would make sense. But that's part of the litigation process, and I agree that that's one part of the solution.
I trust juries there, but I tell you that before the Missouri v. Biden case, we had another case called Changizi, that was brought in the District of Ohio. And in fact, the complaint that we had in the Changizi case was pretty similar. The COVID portion of it was pretty similar to the complaint in Missouri v. Biden. But the judge in Ohio, the district judge in Ohio, didn't allow discovery and dismissed the case at the complaint stage. So would I be happy to be in front of a jury? Sure, but the district judges are gonna have to, there's still going to be gatekeepers there, and if they're not going to let you get to a jury, then that's not going to do you a lot of good. I did want to say that One of the questions we didn't get to that was sort of in your opening paragraph, Judge, was the question of, you know, is this new? Are these actions new? And, you know, yes and no, right? Government's attempts to stifle speech, that's not new. Federal government has been trying to take away people's rights in this area since at least the Sedition Act of 1798, right? So that criminalized false and malicious speech about the federal government. But I think what's changed is that the administrative state has gotten too big for its britches, and we now have thousands of petty tyrants and acronym agencies you've never heard of with thin skins who think that suppressing speech is the easy way to propagate their agendas and hide their pathologies and punish people who stand in their way. And some of the methods that they use are new. 15 years ago, I don't think any bureaucrat would have dreamed of being able to get away with some of the kinds of insidious speech suppression that the New Civil Liberties Alliance is now fighting on a daily basis.
Well, I certainly agree that this is not a new phenomenon. Since the first person has been able to speak, there's been someone else who has wished that they would have shut up. And I bet that they would have been willing to turn to a broader power to make that happen. And so it's been a pernicious, you know, problem throughout history. What I think is kind of unique, and one of the earlier questions alluded to it, is how much human expression now happens over private medium. So that question that was asked from the audience about how we should be viewing the private decisions to regulate the speech is going to be tremendously consequential. And that's the right thing, and the right thing for all of us to be thinking about and asking ourselves over the course of the next few months, if cert is granted in the net choice cases, but certainly over the next few years, if cert isn't granted.
On that note, maybe we'll see you here next year for a panel on just that topic. Thank you to our panelists very much. Thank you to all of you for being here. It was really enjoyable.